This is Fresh Air. Charles Baxter is someone I vaguely knew in college. More precisely, I knew people who knew him, and I got the impression that his fellow would-be writers considered him the real thing. Sure enough, he's since written several collections of short stories and two novels that have been much praised. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani said he has a knack for finding and describing the fleeting moments that indelibly define a life. His new novel, Shadow Play, like most of his fiction, is set in a small Midwestern town. The town of the novel is Five Oaks. Baxter grew up in the small town of Excelsior, Minnesota, which he says was best known for its amusement park. Shadow Play is about a man's relationship with his wife, his children, his parents, and his town. The main character is an assistant city manager named Wyatt. Here's Baxter reading a passage.
One or two of his classmates, he had heard, had become investors. Investors? From Five Oaks? The idea seemed preposterous, but he had been told all this by Harold, his incompetent but friendly barber. One of the more anonymous members of his high school class, Jerry Schwartzwalder, had gone to Minnesota and somehow made a tidy bundle, and was promising to return to Five Oaks and bring that bundle with him, Harold claimed, as he haphazardly cut Wyatt's hair. Wyatt had made himself into a model bureaucrat, good at writing up forms, reading regulations, knowing when to ask the city attorney a question, and when to leave him alone. He fit in. He was learning how to hide information from the city council and the mayor. He had never been quarrelsome and seemed to be able to tell most people what they wanted to hear. When he had bad news to give to someone, he suggested just the right amount of distress by wrinkling his brow. He had a small office close to the coffee machine, near the office for special events, run by a woman named Elise Snyder. It all seemed to be going according to some sort of plan.
And of course, that plan changes kind of soon. Well, at the center of your new novel is the attempt to make a compromise for what at first seems to be the larger good. Wyatt, the main character, meets with an old friend who's left the city, and this old friend has developed successful chemical companies. And the idea is to bring him back into town and get jobs for the cities and jobs a job for Wyatt's cousin. But, of course, it's a chemical company, and the chemicals that are being produced and the byproducts of that production are very dangerous, as it turns out.
Right.
Do you think that this is the typical modern dilemma, having to decide which compromises are really worth it? I mean, these people aren't exactly sitting down trying to do evil, but there's a lot of danger that comes out of this.
Well, there are a lot of trade-offs, and of course I've staked my claim on the belief that in fact it is a common sort of trade-off. I live, for example, about 2 miles away from a medical filtration plant that a few years ago was pumping byproducts into the ground, byproducts of the manufacturing, into the groundwater, so much so that there were suits and countersuits. And when the whole thing came up for adjudication, the usual defense was that there were many, many people being employed by this place. I think that all over the country right now, in various cities and small towns, we're being confronted by the trade-off of employment and, as one of my characters says, spilling a bit of hoo-ha on the floor. And there's a lot of hoo-ha being spilled on the floor these days. Everybody knows it. It's just a matter of how much tolerance we have for hoo-ha.
So you are not the kind of assistant city manager type person who would be cutting deals to bring chemical plants into town in the hopes that it would revive the economy and open new job possibilities. I mean, you're a writer and teacher. But there must have been other potentially compromising decisions you've had to make in your life that kind of resonated with the decision that you've put into this book?
Anybody who teaches in a university learns plenty about compromises and about bureaucracies. So there's that to start with. And it also seems to me that I'm in possession of an interesting, well, I'm not sure whether it's a virtue or a character flaw. It's the fact that I tend to be rather accommodating, particularly for temperamental people. And when I began to think about this novel, I started to think of it as the tragedy, or let's say a tragicomedy, of a particularly accommodating person, the sort of nice guy who tries to do the right thing for everybody and who gets himself into a terrible pickle. Because given the kind of job he has and the sorts of things that the town requires of him, that his cousin requires of him, he can't be a nice guy for everyone. And before very long, he has made some decisions that are virtually criminal in their implications.
Was there a turning point type event in your life where you realized that you had gone too far in accommodating somebody?
Well, I don't know if there is or not. I think that when you are a child of temperamental, interesting, but temperamental parents, the youngest son of three children, you find sometimes, or let's say I found, that I was, in fact, sometimes accommodating myself too well. It's interesting to me that the self-help movement is in part meant for people of my type, people who have been nice guys, who have been accommodating, who have tried to do their best for others and sort of have forgotten how to say no to things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Charles Baxter. His new novel is called Shadow Play. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Charles Baxter is my guest, author of the new novel, Shadow Play. Let me get back to your parents. You described your parents as temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
The mother in your novel is well, insane. I mean, kind of crazy. I don't know what word to use. You help me here. Insane?
Mad? No. I never thought of her as insane. I've always been somewhat annoyed by the way people with emotional trouble are presented in fiction. And I thought that what I would do with this woman was to present a character for whom nothing made much sense anymore. And so she sounds crazy to other people around her. But in fact, she always made sense to me. But if you're asking me if my mother was like that, I'd have to say, no, she wasn't. My stepfather was about as eccentric as people ever have to be. But my mother, no, she wasn't.
In what way was your father eccentric?
Well, my stepfather had, at some point early in his life, read, it seems to me, too many English novels and conceived the idea of buying an estate, which he managed to do during the Depression with some money from his first wife, where he lived very much in the English style, almost out of a novel by Henry James. Some would say the Bostonians. I thought it looked more like the Turn of the Screw. After my father died, I was brought up on this place, which was called World's End. And we had a cook and a caretaker. We had nursemaids and a laundry woman. It all sounds quite enviable, except that the nursemaids who raised me and my brothers were, like the nursemaid in the Turn of the Screw, sometimes a bit nuts. And so it wasn't all peaches and cream out there.
The aunt who actually raises the children in this novel, who raises the main character when he was mm-hmm. young, she's writing a new version of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
a pretty eccentric thing to do.
It is? I don't know why more people don't do it.
What inspired you to create a character who did it?
Well, I thought that in this culture where everything is altered and changed every few months or so, that there might quite conceivably be a character who has the feeling that the God that she experiences happens not to be the God in the Bible. Now, if that's true, then you either have to find a Bible that has that God in it, or you have to write your own Bible. And she's a fairly headstrong woman, and she thinks that the God that she experiences, which is always right behind her, she can never quite turn around to see it, but it's always there, and which has no gender, by the way. She doesn't feel that it's either a he or a she. It's just a principle. It's a feeling. And what it is a principle of curiosity. It's a watcher God that wants to see everything happen and happen over and over again. It likes to see these things happen, but it doesn't love us. She thinks that the God who loved us is gone, and this other God has taken the first God's place. And since nobody else is around to write the Bible about this new God, she just settles in and does it. She's a great one for collecting what she calls evidence. Her house is filling up with old newspapers, old magazines, records of whatever happens or has happened in the world, because that's what this God has brought on.
You know, growing up with temperamental parents and eccentric nursemaids, do you think that that turned you into an accommodating person because the people around you were so demanding and in some cases maybe off the beam?
Well, if you're raised by people who have more or less taken leave of the house and put you in the care of nursemaids who have in some way or other found their soul on another planet, I guess you'd be fairly accommodating. Sure you would. My brothers put up some resistance to this and were promptly sent off to military school. So I saw the handwriting on the wall, and since I wasn't much for the disciplines of military school, I learned what it meant to go along. Now, I don't think that's really a good thing, but I do think that in a culture of bureaucracy, many people have, in fact, learned this skill to their surprise and in some ways to their, well, maybe horror is too strong a word, but it's the one that comes to mind.
Are eccentrics attracted to you because they recognize that you would understand them and maybe be accommodating toward them?
Yes, I used to wonder about this. It seemed to me that I had the most peculiar set of acquaintances. I don't mean my close friends. I mean the people who had a tendency to call me up and to talk for an hour or two. My wife never understood why I listened to these people. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that if you want to hear true prophecy, you'd better listen to the people who don't know how to stop talking. That if you really want to hear the wisdom and the strangeness of the age being expressed, you'd better keep your eyes and your ears open to folks of this kind. I seem to have known quite a few of them, and the fact is that I've always enjoyed their company, starting with my aunt and her friends and going down to the people that whom I know now.
Mm-hmm. Novelist Charles Baxter is my guest. He'll be back with us in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charles Baxter, author of the new novel Shadow Play. Death has a part in your new novel. How old were you when you lost someone who was very close to you for the first time?
I was 18 months old when my father died very suddenly of a heart attack at a picnic. And although I have almost no memory of, in fact, I have no memory of him and no memory of these events, my two brothers claim that I would go to the upstairs window and wait for him to come home after he had died. It was a place that I usually sat waiting for him. And there's an episode a little bit like that late in my novel, except that I rewrote my own life by having the father come back instead of disappearing, and I rewrote myself as the little boy, Eugene, who waits for the father to come home. That's one of the great pleasures of writing fiction. You can take an episode from your own life and rewrite it in the way that you wish it had happened, but didn't happen. You can't do that too often. After a while, it'll start to look like a set of lies, but you can do it now and then.
So in your own life, you were facing the death of someone close to you before you even comprehended what it was.
My whole life was defined. My whole early life was defined by it. There was no escaping it. Everything that occurred in my life, down to where I lived and whom I lived with, was defined by that death. So I came to think of it as an event, death that is, that defines the way one comes to live. I don't mean that morbidly. I just mean it, I think, in a matter-of-fact way.
Do you feel that as a person you are divided between wanting a family-centered, calm, focused life and wanting something more eccentric, more unusual, more unrestricted?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I'm very much a homebody. I'm very domestic. I once had my auras read by someone who claimed to be psychic, and she said that there was a thick purple aura around me, and that was the sign of domesticity. And she even saw a visionary dog at my feet with its front paws crossed, and apparently the dog was the sign of what did she say? She said that he was guarding me. Guarding my life. It all seemed very comfortable, but I'm like many people. If you scratch the surface, there's a bit of the desperado inside. My nickname as a child was Desperate Ambrose, and I think if you scratch most homeowners, men and women, you will find a kind of streak of some wild man or wild woman who wants to get out. I think that's true. At least I worked on this novel in the faith that it was.
I've left you a minute for this question. I'm sorry. Do you ever do something that shocks yourself? Are you ever really shocked at what you feel or what you do?
Yes. Not very often, but sometimes I find myself, particularly when I'm in a strange city, when I'm traveling and there's no set agenda, I'll start wandering around and finding myself in a place I hadn't expected to be. I think that anybody who sits down to write stories had better become fairly well acquainted with their shadow side, because it's that shadow side that gives an interesting kind of darkness, the bass notes, to a story. I think if you felt that you yourself were completely justified in everything that you did, and you had all of your impulses completely under control, Well, I don't know where the stories would come from, because I think stories tend to start when things begin to go wrong. And the more you have a sense of your own potential for that, the more interesting your stories will be.
Charles Baxter teaches at the University of Michigan. His new novel, Shadow Play, is published by Norton.